Katra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, well, we're tackling a really big one, a foundational text that, honestly, even a century and a half later, still sparks so much debate and shapes how we think about, you know, our economy, our society.
That's right. We're talking about Karl Marx's Capital.
Exactly. Capital. It's one of those books, isn't it? Many people have heard of it, maybe argued about it, but maybe haven't really gotten into the weeds.
Yes, dense stuff.
It is. So what we've done is gathered insights from some really good summaries and abridgments. Our goal here isn't to convince you of anything, really.
No, not at all.
It's more about cutting through some of the noise, maybe demystifying the complex ideas a bit. We want to show you why its core arguments about profit, exploitation, class struggle, why they still feel, well, pretty relevant today.
Mm-hmm.
Think of this as your accessible guide to a book that genuinely changed the world.
And I think what's really crucial to get right from the start is that Marx wasn't just like describing things he saw in the economy.
Right.
He was dissecting it, critiquing it really meticulously. He wanted to answer this huge question: where does profit actually come from?
Yeah, where does the extra money appear?
Exactly. And what are the sort of internal rules, the laws of motion that make the capitalist system tick?
Okay.
His goal was to pull back the curtain, you know, to show the hidden social stuff, the power dynamics, the exploitation that he argued was lurking beneath what looks like, well, fair market exchanges.
Just everyday buying and selling.
Precisely. It gives you a lens, a powerful critical lens to understand the world.
Okay, so before we dive into the arguments themselves, maybe we should talk a bit about the person behind it, Karl Marx.
Definitely helps to understand where he was coming from.
Yeah, born in 1818. I mean, this guy was a powerhouse intellectually, not just one thing, right? Yeah. Philosopher, economist, mm-hmm. historian, sociologist.
Political theorist, journalist.
Revolutionary socialist, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
His thinking was this incredible blend. He took German philosophy, especially Hegel's ideas about dialectics.
Right, the idea of conflict driving change.
Mixed it with French utopian socialist ideas.
Yeah.
And then really grappled with British classical economics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Adam Smith, David Ricardo.
That synthesis is key. He wasn't just starting from scratch. He deeply studied those classical economists like Smith and Ricardo.
So he understood their arguments inside out.
Exactly. He adopted their rigor, their tools, but then used them to critique their own conclusions, to show what he saw as contradictions.
Mm.
And it wasn't just books. His life experience was crucial. He was a political exile in London.
Right in the heart of the Industrial Revolution.
The absolute epicenter of 19th century industrial capitalism. He saw the factories, the conditions, the poverty firsthand. It was raw.
Wow.
And he backed it up with research. Decades, literally decades, spent in the British Museum.
Just reading.
Reading everything. Government reports, factory inspector logs, economic data, historical accounts. He grounded his big theories in this mountain of concrete evidence about worker exploitation.
So Capital wasn't just like an abstract treatise.
No, it was his magnum opus, his life's work, an attempt to lay out the economic anatomy of modern society, you could say, to provide a scientific basis for his political ideas.
Okay, so let's get into that core argument then. What is the absolute heart of Capital?
Well, it really boils down to this. Marx argues the whole capitalist system is driven by one thing, the relentless pursuit of profit.
Okay, making money.
Making more money. And this is the crucial bit. He says that profit is generated through the systematic exploitation of wage labor.
Exploitation, that's a strong word.
It is. And he was trying to solve this puzzle, this paradox that even Adam Smith kind of stumbled over.
Which was?
If goods are exchanged at their true value, and they mostly agreed, value comes from the labor needed to make them.
Right, the labor theory of value.
If that's true, how does a capitalist start with some money, buy things, sell things, and consistently end up with more money? MCM, remember?
Yeah, it seems like you should just break even if everything's exchanged fairly at its value.
Exactly. It seems to defy fair exchange, doesn't it?
So what was Marx's solution?
His solution is... well, it's clever and quite radical. He identifies a unique commodity, something special you only really find under capitalism.
Okay.
Labor power.
Not labor itself, but labor power.
Precisely. It's the worker's ability or capacity to work. That's what they sell to the capitalist for a wage.
Because they don't own factories or land, they have to sell their ability to work.
Right. And the unique thing about this commodity, labor power, is its use value, what it can do.
Which is?
It can create more value than its own cost.
Ah, okay. I think I see where this is going.
Yeah. So the capitalist pays the worker a wage that covers the cost of the worker's labor power, basically, enough for them to live, eat, rest, and come back tomorrow. Let's say that's equivalent to 4 hours of work. But the capitalist has bought their labor power for the whole day, say 8 hours or 10 or 12 back then.
Right.
Those extra hours, beyond what's needed to cover the wage, that's unpaid labor.
Unpaid labor.
And the value created during that unpaid labor time, that's what Marx calls surplus value.
Surplus value. So that's the source of the extra money, the M.
That's exactly it, according to Marx. Profit comes directly from this unpaid surplus labor extracted from the working class.
Wow. Okay, so that implies the system isn't harmonious at all.
Not in his view. It's fundamentally antagonistic. There's an inherent conflict baked right in between the owners, the bourgeoisie, who want to maximize surplus value.
And the workers, the proletariat, who are trying to, well, survive and maybe limit that exploitation.
Exactly.
It's like Marx takes us on this journey starting really small, right, with the commodity.
Yes, the basic building block.
Anything you buy, basically. A coat, a phone.
Your coffee this morning.
Right. And he says it has this dual nature. First, its use value.
What it does for you. The coat keeps you warm. The coffee wakes you up. Simple enough.
But then there's its exchange value, which you can trade it for. You know, the coat might be worth 20 yards of linen or 50 quid or whatever.
The market price, essentially.
But here's where he gets really interesting, I think. Commodity fetishism.
Ah, yes. This is a fascinating concept.
It is. It's how, in our market economy, the actual social relationships between the people making things get hidden.
They vanish almost.
Yeah. What? We just see the price tag. We compare prices. We react to the market. But we don't really see the tailor who made the coat or the farmer who grew the coffee beans or the conditions they worked under.
It's like the relationships between people get twisted into relationships between things mediated by money.
The market seems like this impersonal force with its own rules.
Making us forget the human effort and social connections underneath.
So that leads to the question, how can we compare a coat and, say, linen? What makes them equivalent in exchange?
What's the common substance? Marx's answer is human labor. Abstract human labor.
Okay, the labor theory of value again.
Right. The value of a commodity is determined by the amount of socially necessary labor time it takes to produce it.
Socially necessary, meaning?
Meaning the average time needed using the typical technology and skill level available in society at that time.
Ah, so if I spend a week hand carving a spoon, but a machine can churn one out in 5 minutes.
The socially necessary labor time and therefore its value in the market is closer to those 5 minutes. Your extra labor doesn't count towards its exchange value.
Got it. Okay. And this connects to how money becomes capital.
Yes. He contrasts two different circuits. First is CMC, commodity, money, commodity.
So I make a commodity C, sell it for money M, and use that money to buy another commodity C I need.
Exactly. The goal is consumption. You're satisfying needs.
But the capitalist circuit is different.
Very different. It's MCM, money commodity, more money.
Start with money, M, buy commodities, C, and this is key. Those commodities include machinery, raw materials, and labor power.
Right. Then use those commodities in production to create new commodities, which are then sold for more money than you started with.
And the goal isn't just to get your money back or even just to consume.
The goal is the endless expansion of that initial M. Has to be bigger than M. That difference, M minus M, is the surplus value. That's the driving force.
And Marx says the secret to where that prime, that M prime, that extra bit comes from, it's hidden away, not obvious in the marketplace.
Right. He calls it the hidden abode of production. It's not in the buying and selling itself. It's inside the factory, the workshop, the workplace.
Where that special commodity, labor power, is actually used.
Exactly. The worker sells their capacity to work because they have no other way to survive. The capitalist pays them a wage.
And we said that wage covers maybe 4 hours worth of value produced, enough to keep the worker going.
Yes, what Marx calls necessary labor time, the time needed to produce the value equivalent to their wage.
But the capitalist uses their labor power for the full working day, 8-10 hours.
All the time beyond that necessary labor time is surplus labor time.
The worker is still working, still creating value.
But they're not getting paid for that extra value they're creating. It goes entirely to the capitalist.
And that is the sole source of surplus value and therefore profit.
That's the core of the exploitation argument in Capital.
Okay, so this explains why there's always this tension over the working day.
Absolutely. A constant struggle. Capitalists inherently want to lengthen the working day or make work more intense within the same hours to maximize that surplus labor time.
While workers naturally push back for shorter hours, better conditions.
It also changes how you look at machinery and technology.
Yeah, we tend to think of tech as making life easier, right?
And it can, potentially. But Marx argues that under capitalism, its primary function, its driving force, is actually to increase the rate of exploitation to boost surplus value.
How does it do that?
Two main ways. First, absolute surplus value. This is simply making people work longer hours for the same pay, or making them work harder in the same time. Pretty straightforward extension or intensification.
Okay.
Second, relative surplus value. This is more subtle. Technology increases productivity. Workers can now produce the value equivalent to their wage much faster.
Ah, so if it took 4 hours before, maybe now it only takes 2 hours thanks to a new machine.
Exactly. Which means in an 8-hour day, the surplus labor time jumps from 4 hours to 6 hours.
Even though the working day length hasn't changed, and the wage might even be the same.
Right. The proportion of unpaid labor time increases. Plus, machinery often de-skills labor.
Makes workers more interchangeable.
Yes, potentially easier to replace, weakening their bargaining power. Technology becomes a tool in that class struggle.
So, connecting this all up, what happens with all this surplus value that's generated? Capitalists don't just spend it all on luxuries, right?
Some do, of course. But the system itself, the competition between capitalists, forces them to reinvest most of it. To stay competitive, you need to buy better machines, expand production, find ways to produce more cheaply than your rivals. If you don't, you get driven out of business.
So they have to constantly reinvest surplus value back into the business to make even more surplus value.
Exactly. That's the engine. Capital accumulation. It's compulsive.
And Marx argues this accumulation has some major consequences built into it.
Two huge ones he highlights. First, the concentration and centralization of capital.
Meaning?
Wealth and the means of production, factories, machines, land, tend to end up in fewer and fewer hands. Big fish eat little fish. Successful capitalists grow, absorb competitors, or drive them under.
You see that trend today, for sure. And the second consequence?
The creation of what he called the reserve army of labor.
A pool of unemployed people.
Yes, unemployed and underemployed. A permanent feature of the system, he argued. It's functional for capitalism.
Oh, what's up?
Well, it keeps wages down for those with jobs, because there's always someone ready to take their place. And it provides a flexible workforce that capital can draw on when it wants to expand rapidly.
That sounds pretty bleak.
Yeah.
Marx had this general law of accumulation, didn't he?
He did. Essentially, it suggests that as capital accumulates at one pole, wealth for the capitalists, misery, or at least relative deprivation and insecurity, accumulates at the other pole, the working class, the gap widens.
Wow. Okay, so that explains how the system runs. But how did it start? Did it just evolve peacefully?
Marx tackles this head on. He completely debunks the sort of fairy tale that capitalism just emerged from people being thrifty and saving up.
The hard work and savings origin story.
Right. He calls the actual historical process primitive accumulation, and he argues it was anything but peaceful.
Primitive meaning, like the first or original accumulation.
Exactly. The accumulation that got the whole thing started. He argues it was based on outright theft, violence, and expropriation. Forcing people off their land, separating them from their means of producing their own livelihood.
Can you give examples?
The classic one is the enclosure movement in England. Common lands, which peasants used for centuries, were forcibly fenced off, privatized, turned into sheep farms, or large-scale agriculture for profit.
Kicking the peasants off the land.
Leaving them with nothing, nothing to sell but their ability to work their labor power. They were forced into the cities and factories.
Creating the working class.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And he also points to the plunder of colonies, slavery, conquest, resource extraction as massive sources of this initial capital. State power, laws, debt were all used to violently create this propertyless working class.
So the separation of workers from the tools and land needed to produce wasn't natural. It was historical, often brutal.
That's his core argument about the origins, a violent historical act, not a gentle evolution.
It's pretty striking how these ideas, you know, from the 19th century still seem to resonate or offer ways to analyze things today.
Absolutely. Think about modern work and wages.
Yeah.
Why is it that in many places productivity has soared over the last few decades, but wages for many have stagnated or barely kept up?
Good question.
Marx's framework points towards increased rates of exploitation, maybe through relative surplus value, intensification of work, and the persistent power imbalance in wage negotiations because of that reserve army or globalization.
And economic inequality.
Yeah.
The massive gaps we see.
Capital offers a structural explanation. It's not just about individual luck or effort. It's baked into the system's tendency towards concentration of capital and the dynamics of surplus value extraction.
It also makes you think about financial crises, like 2008.
Right. From this perspective, they aren't just unfortunate accidents or policy mistakes. They're almost predictable results of the system's internal contradictions, its drive for endless accumulation hitting limits.
What about consumer culture? All the brands, the advertising?
Commodity fetishism. It's incredibly relevant there. It helps us understand why we desire certain brands, how advertising gives objects these almost magical qualities. And importantly, it prompts us to look behind the product.
To the hidden labor, the environmental costs.
Exactly. The social relations obscured by the price tag.
And technology. AI, automation, the gig economy.
Marx's analysis pushes us to ask critical questions. Is this new tech genuinely liberating workers? Or is it intensifying work, de-skilling jobs, creating more precarious work, a sort of modern digital reserve army?
Who benefits most?
That's the question he forces you to ask. And even on a global scale,
yeah.
His ideas on primitive accumulation, the drive for new markets and resources, they offer powerful ways to analyze colonialism, neocolonialism, the dynamics of global capital flows, and how wealth extraction continues today.
The book is also full of these incredibly powerful, almost literary lines, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. He could really turn a phrase.
Like, accumulate, accumulate. That is Moses and the Prophets.
Yeah, capturing that obsessive, relentless drive of capital accumulation. It's almost religious in its fervor.
And this one is profound. Capital's not a thing, but a social relation between persons established by the instrumentality of things.
Right. It's not just the money or the machines. It's the power relationship between people expressed through those things. That's crucial.
And the one about its origins. Capital comes dripping from head to toe, from every pore, with blood and dirt.
Stark. A reminder of that violent history of primitive accumulation he described. Unforgettable image.
And maybe one more about progress. Within the capitalist system, all methods for raising the social productiveness of labor are brought about at the cost of the individual labor.
Yeah, suggesting that progress under this system often means intensifying the burden or exploitation of the worker, even as overall output increases. It's a challenging thought.
So stepping back from it all, what's the biggest thing you take away from digging into capital again?
For me, what's really fascinating and enduring is how capital gives you this critical toolkit.
The toolkit.
Yeah. It equips you to look beneath the surface of just everyday economic life, buying, selling, working, to see the power dynamics, the social relationships, the exploitation that might be hidden there.
So it makes you question things you might take for granted.
Exactly. It shows that economics isn't some neutral science operating on its own. It's deeply political. It's about who gets what, who has power, and why. It forces you to see the social structure behind the market.
For me, I think the most striking thing is the idea that this system we live in, it isn't like a force of nature. It's not inevitable.
Right, it's historical.
It's a human-made system constructed over time, often through conflict. And because it's human-made, it has these built-in conflicts and real human consequences. It's not static. It's dynamic, full of contradictions.
That's a powerful realization.
It really is. So maybe a final provocative thought for you, the listener. How does understanding Marx's Capital, even just these core ideas, challenge your basic assumptions about how our economy works? And what might that imply about our collective power, our agency in shaping economic systems for the future? See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.